We made this.
Then welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. My name is Kurt North and welcome to this special edition of our podcast in which we're going to do a little interview. And we're also bringing on our sister show, The X-Cast, as well, as we have an actor who has appeared in both shows. And that person is Stephen E. Miller, who joins me today over in Vancouver. So, Stephen, nice to meet you. And how are things over the pond there?
Things are very good. It's the weather's getting cold and rainy, typical X-Files millennium weather. And, you know, we're out of daylight savings time now, so it's nice and dark and gloomy. And so perfect.
Yeah, well, we're a week ahead of you. I think we had our daylight saving time last week. So it's
hey, man, the weather's always bad over there. I know that. I've been
Well, it's bonfire night today, and we're about to, on our time recording anyway, and we're about to go into lockdown. So if anyone hears any fireworks in the background, that is purely me. The UK is just about to head on into quiet times again, but I think there'll be a bit of frivolity before we do that. So but it's a pleasure to speak to you. It's a long time ago, so I do appreciate that, you know, we're going all the way back to the early 90s, and in X-Files' case, 1993. But before we do that, I just wanted to just touch upon some of the things that you've done over in your past, really, just the stuff that what brought you here. So I believe that you've done a master's in creative writing. You've obviously got some novels and things like that. So do you want to just give us just a brief idea of how you came to acting before that, and the things that you did up until that point?
Sure. I came up to Vancouver from, I was born in North Carolina, and I came up to Vancouver in the late 60s in the middle of the Vietnam War. I had gone to military college, Virginia Military Institute, and I was an officer in the American Army. And after I graduated, they allowed me to go to graduate school. And I came to graduate school at University of British Columbia in creative writing. That was about the only thing I was good at. I was a pretty crappy student. and I had to take two courses. I took prose and I took playwriting, and I didn't know anything about plays. I'd seen my high school play, but I hadn't seen any other drama. And so I started going to plays that were being put on there at the theater department. And I loved it. It was just like, I've told people many times, it was like someone reached inside my head and just flipped a switch. And I started spending all my time over there. I was pretty handy. I became a stage carpenter and an electrician. And because it was Vietnam era, a lot of the plays were being refocused with Americans as the villains. And because I was from the South and had a Southern accent and stuff, they would, and I was a young guy and I was in shape and stuff, and they would plug me in as being a thug, and maybe I'd have one or two lines, you know, and beat somebody up or something like that. And so I really enjoyed it, and I got better and better at it. And I wasn't really a student there, but they would use me whenever they could. And then we formed a theater company immediately upon graduation. And started doing that. And there were no movies or TV shows being done in Vancouver at that time. That was in the 70s. And then we adopted a tax shelter formula in Canada in 1978, similar to what the Australians were doing when they did Breaker Morant and Picnic and Hanging Rock and My Brilliant Career and all those great Australian movies. And we did sort of the same thing. And at that point, there was a lot of work in the movies, and I figured I'd never, ever get the chance to be in a movie again or a TV show. So I sort of thought that was cool and started doing that. And because I was an American and all these movies were being shot in Vancouver, but with pretend American locations, and also by then I'd worked a lot. I'd done a lot of theater and I'd done a couple of little short films. So I got into the career path that way. And by the early 80s, I had a fair amount of experience. And it just kept going. And I got married in 1980, and we had a son in 1981. And by then it was like, okay, it's time to earn a living.
Yeah.
And I just became a full-time film actor after that, pretty much. I tried to do one play a year so I wouldn't forget how to act.
Right.
And, you know, and it just kept going and kept going, and it got bigger and bigger here. Even after the tax shelter formula was dropped, which was, I think, in 1982 or something like that, we just kept making movies and TV shows. And people, I think what happened was people discovered the location and discovered the advantages of shooting up here. We had a lot of people. We had a lot. By that point, we had a whole lot of people who knew what they were doing. And so it's, you know, I don't act very much now at all. I've made enough money, and I don't really need to scratch that itch as much as I do my writing itch, which I had put on hold for a long time, and only picked that up again sort of in the 90s. Yeah, that's how I got into it. Yeah,
there's a couple of things that I noted down actually before coming to speak to you, because there's a lot of resonance between, say, the UK and Vancouver and the way that things go. I mean, you've got the obvious ones like Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen, who have come from a theatre background, and I'm really curious to, because there does seem to be that that kind of unit in Vancouver. Of obviously, there's a lot of TV shows out there. But there's obviously the theatre side of things. I mean, was there it, on the theatre scene in Vancouver? It was like that kind of family spirit and the reoccurring actors that you might see on TV and screen. How does that all work over there? And did it feel like, obviously, knowing people left, right, and centre, really?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. You if you started at the same time I did, you were really one of maybe 150 people who were involved in the business. And when they made the George C. Scott film, The Changeling, in Vancouver, and before that, I'm not sure of the year, but before they made that movie, we had two crews. So we could only do two things. And there was also the CBC. The CBC had their own crew, but we had two professional type, you know, freelance crews. And when this Changeling came in, that was our third crew, and everybody moved up a notch. You know, all the crew guys got an upgrade because it was their first time, you know, being the DOP and that kind of thing, and or whatever. And so it really, you really did go on a set, and you knew everybody. You knew the crew people, you knew the Teamsters, you knew the catering people. It was just really like a fraternity and a sorority all rolled into one. It was great. It was really, really fun. And you knew who you could trust, you know, people. And the camera departments were fantastic with local people, because a lot of times you'd be working with a director who had been parachuted in from L.A. and they didn't really know anybody. And the camera crews would sort of, they'd make sure you got your shot, you know. If something wasn't right, they'd kind of reframe the shot, you know, and give you a little bit of a boost. So it was a wonderful time. And you would see people like Alex Dyke and, you know, and Tom Macbeth, and you'd run into them doing theater too, you know, all the time. So, and we'd go to the same bar, you know, and all that. You know?
Yeah.
It was really, really a real family atmosphere in those years, especially.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of feeling that I've got just from the research that I've done over the years with the X-Files.
Tom Braidwood, yeah. who was Frohickey, was one of the lone gunmen. Tom was one of my very best friends.
Right.
And Tom and I were in the same theater company. We had our own theater company, me and my wife and, you know, a whole bunch of us. And, you know, Tom and I wrote scripts together and, you know, we had our children were born 1 week apart.
Right. Right, okay.
While we were doing theater production of Bent. So we gave out cigars together to everybody, you know.
Yeah.
And it was great.
Well, I think I don't know how much you know about this, but theatre productions over the last like 10 years, pre-COVID, they were getting like not necessarily a renaissance. I mean, obviously, UK is renowned for its London theatre productions and things.
Oh yeah,
but especially at my work at the cinema that I tend to run, that we had a lot of live streamings. Is that something that you would have liked to have seen in your day and age? When
yes, so. And I was a member of Canadian Actors Equity, the theater union. We have a theater union and we have a union for TV and film.
Yeah.
And I was a member of both, and I was an elected counselor for both of those. And when I was a counselor for Equity, the theater union, I said, look, you know, we really should make it easy for people to film or tape our plays. We should try to make that because right now in that time the rules around that were it was not easy at all. You were basically prohibited from doing it. And I've seen so many great things coming out of the UK.
Yeah.
where productions have been streamed. One of my favorite was The Tempest that was done I can't remember, it was done in the round.
Yeah.
As a woman's prison.
Right.
Oh my yeah. God. That was such a great show. And they did such a good job of that. And I'm just a big fan of doing that. I'd love to take part in more of that. We're just starting to do it here.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, there's a couple of productions, especially that I probably wouldn't have seen. And I know that a lot of the fans on the X-Cast, especially, have gone to the show and actually seen the show, but things like what Gillian's been in. So mm-hmm. All About Eve and Streetcar Called Desire and all those right. that, you know, a lot of people, especially from where I'm from the north of England. So, you know, getting down to London for a show can cost a lot of money. And especially nowadays, you can't do it full stop.
Right.
But but it's just nice that the people are being exposed to that kind of atmosphere where they wouldn't necessarily have that option. And that goes for opera and ballet as well, as well as theater. But
the dance. There's this, we've been, like everybody else, we've been locked down and, you know, glued to our TV, you know. Mm. And there have been so many nice dance productions that have been shown. This Pina Bausch thing that was done on the beach by the people in Senegal.
Right.
It was just a fantastic, and they did it as a rehearsal. I thought, whoa, you know. I love that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one that we always seem to get every year, which was really good for the kids, is the Nutcracker, because that is always sold out. So just before we talk about your book, I just wanted to get your opinion. I don't know how much you watch modern TV now compared to then, and then we'll talk about the X-Files and Millennium shortly.
Sure.
That with you being a writer and the way that modern TV's kind of changed tack. So when you, for example, you're in Da Vinci's,
Da Vinci's Inquest.
Inquest, yes. And Millennium, they were shows where, and even The X-Files was the beginning of this, and then you move into the likes of Lost, where it became more serial-based again. It kind of started to move into that mold. With mm-hmm. modern TV now, with the likes of you know, things like Lovecraft Country and Watchmen and TV shows like that, where it's almost chapter based, it's a 10-episode yes. arc of a story.
Yes.
With your novelization, the way that you write as well, is that something that you've really enjoyed in TV nowadays? And would you like to see an adaptation of something like that with the way that you write? Is that something that you think is good for TV?
Yeah, for sure. I think it all started with Hill Street Blues.
Yeah.
The long arc, you know, and for anybody who's like a prose writer, a novelist or something like that, that's a really exciting way to do something, to have enough time to explore the characters fully and have a little digression here and there if you want to sort of use that to say something. And I think that's getting more, it's certainly getting more and more popular with the writers. And since people have started to be able to binge a series and not have to wait, you know, for next week's episode, the long arc thing is, I think it's here to stay. It's not going to go away. And I really do enjoy it. I'm sort of working on something now that it ironically is against that, but it's more like a comic or a graphic novel. All right, kind okay. of episodic yeah. sort of thing. But it's the only thing I've really done like that. I've always been a long form person, and I got hired, Chris Haddock, who was the showrunner and creator of Da Vinci's Inquest and Da Vinci City Hall, hired me to be one of the writers on his last show, which was called the Romeo Section. And we did two seasons of that. And that was a long arc kind of thing. The arc carried over into the second season, and, you know, that, and it was very satisfying. I loved it. It's my sweet spot.
Yeah, and I think it's the way forward. I mean, there's a lot of, as I say, Lovecraft Country is probably the one where they've tried everything in that with that book, that you can go from an X-File to a horror to all kinds sure. and have that episodic thing sure. as well. I know Star Trek's recently, they've had a story arc, and I know that there's a mixture now. There's sometimes like, which we'll get into with Millennium and Andy McLaren, where I wouldn't say it was stock, but it's procedural episodic and there is an arc mm-hmm. to a degree. But even with episodic TV nowadays, there generally is a bigger character arc over the story yeah. rather than yeah. than stuff like that, really. So it leads me to your book writing. So you had to say your creative writing that stuff. You've got a few books out. How do you go about writing a book, and where do the ideas spark from, and what kind of research do you do for your books?
Well, the first books I wrote were historical thrillers, and the two that came out in the UK, which were A Game of Soldiers. It's called A Game of Soldiers over there, HarperCollins, and The Last Train to Kazan, and they were set in the Russian Revolution. And so there was a tremendous amount of research for that. And I have a history degree, and I love research. It's another one of my favorite things to do. I read a lot. So I did film research, and I found old maps and stuff, because if you're writing about Russia, you know, Russia has, there are certain nations in the world that have too much history, and Russia yeah. is one of them, right, you yeah. know, Mexico is another one, you know, they just have way too much history. If you could just go through and delete about two thirds of their history, it would be a far more kinder and gentler nation to spend time in.
Yeah.
But you have to go back with the maps, and you have to find out when they changed the names and who was in power when they changed the names, and what the political situation was. And a lot of times that's very difficult to do because it's been rewritten and revised, and you don't know who's lying. And, you know, but I did a lot of that. And then the most recent book I did, which is The Messenger, was a contemporary book. And the research thing I had to do there, it was a book about biological terror.
Right. Yeah.
And I had to do a lot of research there, but a lot of that research is secret. So that leads you up to a difficult place. You have to decide, okay, how do I work around this? There's no legal way I can find out this stuff. So you have to sort of make it up at that point.
And do you have a routine for when you actually write then? Do you have a set routine, or do you just do it as you
went? I used to write when I was really, really concentrating on this and really, really doing it as a, just like a going to work. I would get up in the morning and I would work until lunch. And I had my breakfast and I'd work until lunch. And then I'd stop in the afternoon. If I was really on a roll, or if I was facing a deadline, which I never really had to face very often, I'm usually pretty fast writer. I might do stuff like revise things in the evening or something like that. If we weren't doing anything or didn't have somebody coming over or something like that, but mostly that was my routine. And now, because I'm doing a lot of babysitting and life
whole
is kind
of
changed.
Research.
Yeah. Now I just basically write whenever I can find the time.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's a much looser thing now. I'm looking for an agent. Sometimes my business sense isn't what it should be because I changed agents, or I left my writing agent just as COVID hit.
Oh, right. Okay.
just right as COVID hit. So now, you know, you can't meet anybody, you know, in person. You can't go out and have coffee. You know, it's really very difficult. You can't travel because I would love to have an agent. Prior to this, my agents were in Toronto, and they were sort of very, very good agents. But now I can't go to Toronto. I can't go to New York. I can't go to L.A. I can't go anywhere, you know, London, you know.
Yeah.
I was really trying to get an agent in the U.K. because the thing that you might not know is I'm sort of obsessed with motor racing.
All right. Okay.
I've been a major car buff ever since I was a teenager. And if I was not watching the election news, I'd be watching the last hours of Le Mans.
Right.
So,
okay.
So I was really hoping to get a UK agent so I could, because they're more into that stuff over there too. And I would like to, I've got a book, a motor racing book that I'm trying to put together. So
that'd be good. It's always best to go into something you enjoy, isn't it? Especially
especially at when you're all grown up, you know. I mean, you know, it's okay to work hard. You know, when you're young, you can work hard for somebody else and it's not so bad, but when you're all grown up, you just want to do your own thing, you know.
And grow up and enjoy life. That's the best way, isn't
it? That's right, for a change.
Okay then. Well, let's talk about what we're here for, what the listeners want to hear about. And I think we'll start with the X-Files being it's you know, chronologically correct. But do you remember what it was like on set of the pilot? You have the the brilliant accolade of being the first person to ever speak on the X-Files.
I know. I did not know that. Somebody had to tell me that.
Right.
I remember doing it. I remember. Nobody knew anything about the show. Nobody knew anything about Chris Carter or David or Joanne. And they, as I recall, they were pretty anal about passing out scripts too. So I don't think we had scripts. Chris Carter, I think, was always very protective of the scripts. And so we got to the set and stuff, and the thing about the pilot was, I think it was shot over 3 weeks, which is a long time for a TV show. That's like a, you know, TV movie or a feature film almost, you know. And nobody knew who these folks were, and David and Jillian, I think it's probably safe to say, in that show, had a kind of a very compressed style of acting.
Right.
They were both very withheld.
Yeah.
David especially was very, very He was not demonstrative. He was a very contained kind of actor. And Gillian, I think, matched that, you know, in her own way. And so it was like, well, God, what are we, you know, who are these two people? You know, they're not doing anything. They're just standing there, you know, like what's going on? And Chris was the pilot. I don't think I'm talking out of school here, but they would, they shoot a scene, you know, we do a take and then there'd be a meeting. You know, there'd be kind of a meeting between the DOP and Chris, and there was a couple of producers there, you know, they'd all kind of huddle, and then we'd do another take, you know, and then they'd have another meeting. And then, you know, we'd stand around and it's raining, and, you know, you say, what the hell? And then we'd do another take. And I don't know what that was all out of earshot for me, but I think what finally happened was that Chris's vision for the show, which probably at that time was a little hard to communicate, eventually won out.
Right.
Because
yeah.
the show became, I mean, he really did, I think, fully see that entire show, you know, and knew exactly where he wanted it to go. I don't think he had a lot of doubts. But that took a little while. And David and Gillian didn't really exactly loosen up, but they made that, it was quite apparent after a couple of episodes that they too knew what they wanted to do. You know, it was just a little strange because, you know, it was the first time anybody had seen that way of doing things. It was, David I like a lot. I like both of those people a whole lot. I lived up on Denman Island in British Columbia, and Gillian had a house up there for a while. And I didn't run into her or anything like that, but, you know, that's another little connection. And, I think they're both really fine actors and nice folks. And Chris Carter, I can't say enough good things about him.
Do you remember the first time that you met Chris then?
Oh, I met him, I think, probably when we auditioned for it. Right. You know, I don't really remember, but I thought, this guy is too good looking to be a, you know, writer. You know, I mean, really, seriously, yeah. He was like, you know, people were falling over when they'd meet him, you know.
Yeah.
He's extremely intelligent guy. You know?
Yeah.
We should all be so lucky.
Living up to his surfer.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned, I mean, the fact that you mentioned obviously David and Gillian finding their way, Chris Carter was obviously very strong in, like, I want Gillian. That's obviously something that he was really, really wanting to do. And ironically, you ended up in the three episodes of the show, three of my favorite episodes, strangely enough. How were you just called back? Was it a case of auditioning for each individual part, or how did that all come around?
I had to audition for any episode that I, you know, of the X-Files, mainly not so much for Chris, I don't think, but for the directors. A lot, you know, it would be different directors.
Yeah.
And I auditioned so many times that I kind of got to know those folks. And Chris, I think in that way, it got to see me do a lot of different things. Mm. And I think that I think all the auditions is what led to me getting the Millennium gig.
Right.
You know, he just saw what I could do.
Yeah.
So that just went on and on. And we got to be friends. He was a good, nice guy. Good guy.
Well, in the pilot as well, it's just something, I don't know if you're aware of this. It's something that's quite, well known in the fandom now, that the casket when it opens up in the pilot and you see the orangutan alien in there that rolls down the hill, that Chris Carter's actually donated that to the X-Files Preservation. They're currently in the middle of restoring it. So do you remember being on set that day Is anything while you're on set, whether it be the three episodes or whatever, that you particularly remember about being on set? And I know that obviously not being the main character, that you wouldn't be, you're on screen for around, say, 5-10 minutes or so. How long were you generally on the set in makeup and the whole, how does the day?
I think I was on that set more than one day for that pilot.
Yeah.
Maybe it might've been another day because there, yeah, I think it was maybe a couple of days. It's been a long time ago.
Yeah.
But a lot of times I think for, Piper Maru.
Yeah.
I was just on for one day there for the one with Steve Railsback. That was, I think, 2 or 3 days.
Right.
I think that was about the time of those. The one with Steve Railsback, that was, I think, the first one that Chris Carter directed.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the episode.
Yeah, it's Dwayne Barry. Yeah.
Dwayne Barry, and it was a two-parter,
yeah.
Right?
That's right, yeah. So it's one just before Gillian gets abducted because obviously she was heavily pregnant at the time.
Right, so, yeah, right. just to have her get it abducted, yeah. She'll come back in a few days.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I think she did as well from all accounts. She literally had the baby and was back to work next week. So
yeah, yeah. Yeah, that one was Chris's first directing gig, and he did this wonderful thing where we had the regular catering, but he added, I think, 2 food trucks to the catering. And everybody, I mean, we just ate like kings. It was like Henry VIII, you know, it was like, right. You know, yeah, it was really, really nice of him. He did stuff like that for the whole shoot. That was more than 2 or 3 days. It was, yeah, I was there for a while now.
Yeah, and with the episodes that you were in as well, I mean, this is just a personal thing from me, is that all the characters that you were memorable for particular reasons. Or I was a big mythology fan, so I used to love the long story arcs and things. So
yes.
The fact that you featured on there, I mean, one particular moment in Dwayne Barry, because Chris Carter wrote that as well, was that he made you say the medulla oblongata, which I thought was, I just love that line. It just sticks with me all the time.
Well, the line, actually, the worst line he ever gave me, and I don't know if he did this on purpose. And when I saw it, I think what had happened is I had gone in. This was the one, the Piper Maru episode. And I had gone in. I think I might have auditioned for a different character and then been given that part.
Right.
And the line was, Hi, my name is Captain Wayne Morgan of the Naval Investigative Services Unit. Yeah. Okay. Now, when you read that, it doesn't look difficult. Right.
Yeah.
But if you try to say that, that's a hell of a line to have to. Hi, I'm Captain Wayne Morgan of the Naval Investigative Service. Yeah, it's just, oh my God. I'm convinced he did that on purpose. It's such a.
Yeah, you know, fantastic.
But and it was one of those things too, where everybody was like looking at me because why can't he say this? You know, this is so simple. Why can't he just introduce himself?
Brilliant, you know? Brilliant.
So
I mean, with the roles that you've been in, because I'll ask one final question on the X-Files, and then we'll move into Millennium. But you were lucky enough to come back on the 2008 film as well. You were in the Nutter Speed Shop just for a brief cameo as well. What was it like after being so long away? It was 10 years pretty much from the final episode of Millennium till then. What was it like being back on a 10-13 set?
You know, it's really nice to see those folks. You know, it's really, really nice. And it feels really good to be invited to the party again. And the interesting thing about that one was there was a whole thing. It was the part in that movie where David is out in the snow, lost out in the snow. And there was a scene that they, I think, got cut out where I was driving home from my store that night. I think this got cut out. I didn't see it anyway. And I see his tracks. And, you know, I come up to this precipice, this effing precipice in the snow. And it was snowing like crazy.
Yeah.
We shot this up in Whistler, which is a big ski destination, and it was a blizzard, and they had this thing set up right on the edge of the cliff, And I'm supposed to see the tracks go off the edge of the cliff,
right, yeah,
and look down there, you know, and I don't know, maybe go somewhere and make a phone call or something like that. But they just took my part out of it. But that took all night to shoot that, to rig that thing up and so that it wouldn't go over the cliff. You know, that was scary. That was actually frightening. But it was really nice to be there. Callum Keith Rennie is another Vancouver guy, you know, who is not nice guy. And it was just good to be back, you know.
Yeah.
Just
well, good to be back. My partner's older sister was in love with Callum Keith Rennie.
Oh, yeah.
for a number of years. But anything else from the X-Files then that anything you can, any memories, any good memories you can remember or anything funny on set, anything like that? I know it's a long time ago, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. I just thought that Chris ran a wonderful ship. You know, he really did. And the atmosphere amongst the crew and everybody was really good. And, I loved it. I just loved it. Yeah. I'd do it again in a heartbeat,
Sure. That's good to hear. It's good, really good to hear. So, yeah, so moving on to Millennium then. I think including the X-Files, because you're involved in the pilot of the X-Files and you're also involved in the pilot of Millennium. Now, Millennium, mm-hmm. obviously, it had something like 17.2 million viewers on the first episode. Was there a distinctive change, if you're thinking back, to being on that three-week session of the Millennium, the X-Files pilot compared to Millennium, because mm-hmm. they know what they're doing now. You mentioned about, there was to and fro in the X-Files one. The Millennium one obviously spent a lot of money on it as well. Was there any major differences between the two? Had they kind of crafted their art at that point, and what was the differences?
The thing that I remember so much about the Millennium, first off, I got cast, Chris cast me, and it was right off the bat. It was, they told me I was going to be a regular.
Right.
So I was going to be, I can't remember my character's name at that point. I was going to be one of Lance's homicide squad buddies.
Yeah.
Along with Stephen Lang and, Bill Smitrovich.
Yeah.
And we were going to be Lance's old, guys in the bullpen. And so I was really happy to get that job. And then the next thing that I really was impressed by and kind of freaked out by was just how dark it was. It was incredibly dark. And I remember saying to David Nutter, he was the director, right?
He was, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember saying, because I met him before in auditions and stuff, and I said, man, this, you know, they're not going to let this go on television. They're not going to let us dig this guy up whose eyes have been sewn together. That's not going to happen. You know, they're going to cut away.
Yeah.
So, and I was amazed at how dark the show was. And I remember very much doing that part of the scene where we were down by the river and the poster, one of the posters has all the cops in their trench coats kind of lined up, and it's as seen from across the river. And that's a great image. And I just thought that was really, really neat. And I liked Lance a lot, and he was a nice guy. That part of it was a little bit hurried. It seemed to me to be a little bit hurried. The stuff once we got out into the woods was they spent more time on that.
Right.
And and then I don't exactly know what happened after that episode, but I think that what happened was that they had some second thoughts about basing everything around the policeman. So I think they, Bill Smitrovich's contract sort of, you know, because he was on for a long gig, you know, he was like the main guy. And I think they just went ahead and just worked their way through that in terms of episodes, and then went on to a different storyline where Millennium became Millennium, and I just got dropped. And I kept thinking, well, God, are they going to call me back? You know, is it, did I do anything wrong? You know? And then, if for the third season, that's when Chris called and said, you're coming back as a different person. So, you know,
obviously it's one of those things. And I'm always, have a bit of trepidation when I'm asking this question, is that, did you dip in and out of the show? Did you watch it religiously? Was it something that you just kind of,
I dipped in and out, at that time, the biggest problem was at that time I had a little boy running around the house, and yeah, you know, yeah.
You don't want to see swamp pies, do you? Really?
Okay, let's cuddle up and watch Millennium. Yeah. You know, you're only seven. You know, that's you'll really like it. It's fun. It's like Mickey Mouse. So no, I didn't actually see a lot of episodes then, and it was before you could sort of easily. Well, I did tape some stuff, so you know, I could have. But then I watched the ones that in the third season I really started paying attention to it.
So Andy McLaren then. So that was obviously your reoccurring role, and I think I'll ask this question while it's fresh in my mind, that throughout your career, it's been very much a working actor. Career of jumping from one thing to another, whether it be Airwolf or Stargate Airwolf, or wherever it be. Yeah, I used to love that show as a kid.
Wow.
But then you've got a few gigs where you've done like these 12 episodes, you've done 23 episodes, sure, and stuff like that within the shows, and with Millennium and with like the Da Vinci stuff and the time that you've got to actually look more into a character. Was that something that you really enjoyed being able to do, the fact that you could actually delve into more of the characterization of it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure, yeah. And I think any good actor wants to fill in the picture, you know, or wants to be, not only for themselves, but also for the audience, you know. And so the more the writers give you, the more you can do. And I was very... And the thing about Millennium was, you never knew. You as an actor, you never really knew where the thing was going. And I don't think the directors did either. I mean, Thomas Wright, who directed a lot of the episodes I was in, we talked about that. You know, it was like, well, yeah, I don't know what this means. I don't know where it's going. You know,
yeah.
But that was part of the attraction of Millennium, you know, was sort of trying to contain it in your imagination, which I don't think is possible. But I know there are a lot of fans out there who have. But it was a lot of fun. Every episode in that was going to be different, and it was a good bunch of people to work with. Clea Scott that's where I met Clea.
Yeah.
And then I met her again when she did another series for my old buddy Chris Haddock, Intelligence.
Right. And,
so I saw her again then, and So
with the wider shows, not only Millennium, but the other shows, like, as I say, Intelligence and Da Vinci. Mm-hmm. Were you given any kind of freedom to, you mentioned imagination there, but also as well, were you given any freedom to think about the character and maybe give your own suggestions, or was it quite a tight thing, or on any of the shows that you did longer term?
Well, I remember with Millennium, a lot of times we'd be sitting around in between shots and stuff and just joking around, really, because nobody knew who was the good guy and who was the bad guy. And we were talking about how Andy, you know, it was going to turn out that Andy ran the whole thing, you know, and stuff like that. And we would sort of lance and, you know, we'd sit around and try to, you know, just guess what the plot was going to be next time. And, you know, I don't think, there was not a whole lot of, you don't have a lot with Millennium and the X-Files. I didn't have a lot of freedom I couldn't do anything more than what was written in the script. Right.
Yeah.
There wasn't any improvisation really or anything like that. Whereas with Da Vinci's, there was a lot of improvisation.
Right.
You could just contribute almost anything you wanted to in that show. And Chris Haddock would, find a way to use it. It was right. that was a wonderful thing to have.
Yeah.
You know, that really truly was. I mean, it was because you're basically working in an atmosphere of trust, you know, and one of the things that made that happen was that Chris Haddock wrote most of the Da Vinci's episodes, and Chris Carter had a true writer's room thing going on. So, you know, you're a little more constrained in a bigger show like a Millennium or X-Files than you were in a small Canadian show, which is kind of a boutique show, you know.
Yeah. I mean, with it being a boutique show, though, I mean, you would have had a lot of, again, talking about the crews, you would have had a lot of them on the shows, a lot of Luminae actors, but behind the scenes as well.
Oh yeah,
you had a lot of directors and things.
Yeah. You saw, you knew everybody, and it was a Canadian show, and it was so you ran into people that you knew all the time, constantly on that show. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So the, some of the directors that you've mentioned, like Nutter and the like, and
I like Nutter a lot. Nutter's great. Yeah, he's a good guy. Yeah.
I mean, and especially his direction. I mean, obviously, looking back at some of the shows that he was such a reliable pair of hands on both the X-Files and Millennium. And, you know, Morgan and Wong obviously took a lot of stuff on for season two. Have you had much to do with Glenn Morgan and James Wong in other things?
I've seen them on when I saw the Millennium After the Millennium, you know,
right, yes,
the documentary,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But no, you know, we didn't see those guys very often. And a lot of times you'd go into the, if they were there for auditions, which they would sometimes be, a lot of times you didn't quite know who they were.
Right. Okay. ominous presence in the corner.
yeah. You know, you kind of walk in and you're in a, you know, freaked out state of mind anyway, you know, you're getting ready. You're kind of like a sprinter getting ready to run your race. Yeah. And you kind of walk into the audition room and, you know, you just want to be given the go sign so that you can act and then get out of there, you know, but,
So with McLaren then, because what I like about his, and again, it's quite some time ago, but what I liked about his character throughout the show is that, especially on his first introduction, you know, you have the marvelous job to, I mean, talk about having the first line of the X-Files, but on the first episode of Millennium that you appear on in season three, you have to make Lance Erickson smile. And especially with all the stuff that went behind the scenes that, you know, it was saying it's such a drag show. It was so dark and Lance Erickson's playing this really stoic character.
Yeah,
and then your character comes in and basically says, "Smile, Frank." So what was it like? I mean, you've mentioned him just briefly, but what was it like working with Frank, especially during that season, during that third year?
Lance Henriksen is a really wonderful guy, and he's really great to work with. And I've done a lot of stuff, you know, I've been in a lot of movies, you know, in small parts and, you know, some big movies and a lot of crappy movies and TV shows. And, you know, Lance is a real genuine human being. He's a really good guy to work with.
Yeah.
And, very charitable, you know, very approachable, you know, not hard to work with on any level. You know, he commiserates with you, you know, to be cold and wet or, you know, it'd be late nights or whatever. And, you know, he'd say the only reward for good work is more work.
Yeah. You know? Right. Yeah.
And you'd have to do another take, you know, or whatever, you know. And he would do this thing too. If I ever forgot a line, he would find a pencil or something, and he'd write it down. He'd say, "Here, just write it down," and I'd write it down, and he'd say, "Now you're going to remember it." Right.
You know? Right. Okay. Yeah.
And I would remember it. He was really good. He's a great guy. Great guy. I'd love to see him again.
Yeah. It comes across on screen, as I say, because it was such a, the third season of the show. You've gone through the first season is like year seven and like very much like the pilot you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the second season, which goes into the mystic and the, you know, literally the end of the world stuff.
Yeah.
And then this third season's kind of like a, you know, kind of like dealing with the aftermath of what happens in the third, in the second. And mm-hmm. your character, it's really interesting over the course of the show, because you get to spend a lot of time with Peter Outbridge, Claire, yes. and Frank and Lance, and it was just a breath of fresh air to see you make him smile in that way on the, as a character. But how playing your character is really interesting, because there's elements of, you can see where they were going with him. There was this frustration of, you know, in very kind of procedural ways that you were the boss, but you're also playing, you've live with Frank before in ex-FBI stuff, that you were almost of the same level. That's the way I yeah. saw it.
Yeah.
And Frank would often say things like, you know, that's not how he did it, Andy. That's not how you were beforehand.
And, yeah. Yeah.
But then you also work, as well as Lance working as Frank with Emma and being a mentor, you were also having to deal with a lot of the Emma side of things and working with Claire. So having to deal with the style of acting with that, the frustration, the having to rein him in, and because there was a lot of like beating down on tables, going, why is that happening, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you feel with the character arc?
Well,
over
you know, I think a lot of that there in TV shows and movies like that, if I can say that about Millennium, there's not hardly any others like that. But
we had this procedural element, didn't it? It was more like the procedural side of things.
The guy who is the boss, guy who is the boss of the leading man cop, is always, no matter what it is, always basically trying to rein him in, and he's always trying to escape the strictures of command. You know. And have freedom to investigate or do whatever he's going to do. And that's just the territory of that kind of part. And so that wasn't new to me, you know.
Yeah.
And also similarly, to be the boss of a kind of a greenhorn or someone trying to claw their way up, you know, it's a bit of a trope.
I
think the trick is with those kind of parts, which have a kind of not really a well-worn aspect to them, but they're recognizable parts.
Yes.
And you just have to try to bring something human to it if you can, you know. And, you know, you're kind of reined in by what you're supposed to say and whatever the situation is. But there is an implied relationship that's going back between Frank and Andy. And there's ways you can sort of refer to that, you know. And if the writers catch on, you know, then the writers start writing for you a little bit. And I think that's what they did. You know, because I've been around enough and those guys had seen me enough that they thought I could, you know, carry some of that weight a little bit, you know, for something a little bit textured than just the standard cop shop kind of dialogue. So, and the other person that I worked with there, who I really liked and got to be, and was a nice guy, and I had worked with before, was Terry O'Quinn.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I had done a movie, The Stepfather, with him back in the day. And his son, he moved into our neighborhood. I lived in Deep Cove in North Vancouver, and so did Terry. And his son his son was the same age as mine. And they went to school together. in the same school. So I saw he used to come over and play, Ollie.
Right.
So that was really nice to have a little relationship there too. Sorry, I just thought of that in the middle of
no,
middle
no, it's okay. I mean, Terry O'Quinn, it was the very reason why I watched the pilot of Lost when Lost came out, because obviously Millennium was before that, and you know, the first inkling of hearing, you know, Terry O'Quinn's doing a new TV show, it was like, right, I'm going to watch that because I love his acting, and you know, and that became Lost, and you know, he became an integral part of that, and it was really nice to see that. Because that was something I was going to touch upon actually with Terry, because you've got this ominous thing in the background, something they did a little bit with Mitch Pileggi with your kind of role, because Skinner in the X-Files was obviously Mulder and Scully's boss, and they played around a little bit with him. Is he on their side? Is he torn between
helping
them and being stuck with a smoking man, that kind of thing? Is that something that you would have liked to see in longer term? Because there is elements within Andy McCarron where there was almost like, well, the Millennium Group have been told this. I don't believe that myself. Would you have liked to have been in that kind of position to be able to play a role like that, where you've got?
I would have loved to have the role grow and change, you know, and stuff. And I was very sad and disappointed when we got canceled before the Millennium, which I never thought, and I just never thought that was possible.
Yeah,
and I still don't think it's possible. It actually didn't happen. Because the show was, I think the show was really, really on the right track, around that time. And, I just couldn't figure out why. I never figured out why.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah, it is frustrating. I know the X-Files did an episode of Millennium, but it was more of an X-File episode with Frank Black in it more than an episode of Millennium, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
So you mentioned about some of the stories within there. Some of them were a bit out there. Did you ever get to a point where it's just like, I'm just going to read the lines? I have no idea what's going on.
Well, I remember, and I'm sorry, I just can't remember this episode, but I'm sure you'll be able to help me out. It's the one where they find the red lacquer bowls. And it's when they have these little hands, these little...
I think it might be Bardo thought.
Child-size hands, right, that they found in this boat.
That's right.
You know, or something like that.
Yeah, they were regrowing the hands. Yeah.
And I remember, I think Tom Wright directed that episode. And I remember sitting and talking with him. He's a really interesting guy. And I don't know what this show is all about. I don't know what this episode, I don't know what it's about. I don't know who's doing what. I don't know. You know, we're just going to do it. You know, we're going to film it. But we don't understand it, and there's no point in trying. it was so out there, and you didn't quite know if it was going to lead to something else in a subsequent episode, or if it was going to be if it was supposed to completely stand alone. It was really an odd, but I love that. I kind of like that. The ability to have a world where something kind of arbitrary like that happens in the middle of an implied longer arc.
Yeah.
You know, you always had the feeling in Millennium that you were going to discover something that would take you to the next place. Even if that never happened, every now and then it would happen. It would take you to the next place, and you'd stay there for a while, and then there'd be a forest of red herrings, and then you had the feeling that you'd moved on a little bit further.
Yeah.
But that one was, I think, pretty standalone.
Just if you were to sum up your time on the 10-13 stuff with X-Files Millennium and obviously the last X-Files film. Overall, how would you describe it if you were trying to describe it to someone about your time on the shows?
Well, I would have to say it was a very collegial time. People were professional. They were really generous. It was there was not a lot of times in movies and TV, particularly as an actor. And if you're not a star, you feel a little bit threatened, maybe hesitant to, you don't really feel like you're part of the family. By the time I was in, by the time I was playing Andy, I knew those guys well enough. I felt I was home. That was my family for a while. And that was a wonderful feeling. And I remember when I was a really young actor and I thought the worst thing to do would be on a TV series. I thought it would be boring. I thought, oh, you're doing the same thing day after day after day after day with the same people, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, oh, this would be awful. But after doing that and also the others I've been in Da Vinci's and stuff, I really liked the unit, being part of the unit.
Yeah.
And that was great. It was just great.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you should say that with actors in general, because you look at shows that came afterwards. I mean, Step Aside and Lance, for example, is probably one of the perfect examples. But you get Kiefer Sutherland when he came onto 24, and then TV became almost like a taboo subject up until this kind of era, didn't it? Whereas now you've got Winona Ryder on Stranger Things, you've got all these shows that have got TV shows on Netflix now, that everyone does it now. So
yeah, people have cut the cord. And streaming is with us, you know, forever. And people are getting, you know, they're doing really interesting long form projects, you know, and I love these sort of things that are like standalone 8, 9, 10 episodes. Yeah. Just boom. That's a great form.
Yeah.
I hope to keep writing in the field. I really do. It's the kind of thing I love. So.
And is that the thing? I know that we're obviously slowing down a little bit now with some of the roles and acting and is the writing kind of the future for you to do and just at your own pace? Or?
I don't think it's possible for me to stop.
Right. That's good to know.
I just don't think I could stop.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Stephen, thank you very much for coming on to the show.
Thank you,
Kurt. An absolute pleasure to speak to you. Yeah. What are your near time? Bear in mind that we've got a really interesting time at the moment. What's in the near future for you?
In the near future for me, depending on this election, I think people should realize this is the day after the American election.
Yeah.
I'm just going to try to live a quiet, generous life and be a good grandfather. And if I get the chance to do more work and write more and stuff, I'm going
to
do it.
Yeah, so it's time for us to sign off. And we do that in the usual way, but I think it's only pertinent that you should finish us off with that, Stephen. So until next time, people, remember...
This is who we are.
Elsewhere, on We Made This. Frame to frame.
Just that there's certain ways that Sean Connery delivered lines in the film that really sort of stuck with me. So when the room is on fire and they're tied up in the Nazis and they go into the fireplace and it spins around, and he just says, "Our situation has not improved." Just his delivery on that line is so dry and droll.
I love it when he goes, "I find that if I just sit down," and then he sits in the seat and then the seat goes, "The solution presents itself." And he's already...
Cerebral Jukebox.
I had to sort of stop what I was doing and get to find out who it was and, you know, see what else she'd done and find out a little bit more about her as well. And she's incredible. Like, I'm totally in love with her now as well.
I mean, just from going off what we're talking about there, it's sort of in her gap year, she learned how to arrange Mediterranean music and then went off and studied both Spanish medieval history and art. In a gap year.
Yeah.
When you're not really supposed to be doing anything.
That's it, yeah, exactly. That's just nuts, isn't it?
Life's milestones.
What song did you pick as your first dance?
Oh.
We have...
I know it.
Yeah, you go ahead.
It's the song Good Day.
Oh, is that our first dance?
Yep. Yep.
No.
Yep.
No.
Yes.
Not our official first dance.
Yep.
No.
Yep.
She's
not
wrong.
The jukebox song.
Yep.
No.
It's the song "Good Day" by Jukebox the Ghost.
That's the first on the album, but that wasn't our first dance. You wrote a song for our first dance.
Oh, that's right, I did.
Amazing.
I did write a song. You surprised me.
That's right, I did. I love that I forgot that.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.